The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. C. Derek Farn is back this week. Farn is a reader at Zero Books, a university lecturer and a teacher, a poet, and a frequent guest on this podcast. This week we discuss John Stuart Mill's argument for free speech as compared to Marx's argument, the Black Bloc, and the idea of the memory hole. It's Thursday, September 7th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you're looking for a book to help you understand late capitalism, pick up The Writing on the Wall, which is a collection that brings an understanding of Marx's value theory to bear on political questions, Chris Nynum's How the Establishment Lost Control, and of course, Angela Nagel's Kill All Normies, which is turning out to be a great conversation piece, and as I always say, it's guaranteed to transform any leftist get-together into a struggle session. If you enjoy this podcast, consider joining the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast entitled Inside Zero Books, which sometimes features the second half of conversations with Zero Squared guests, and sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers about the state of the left. Zero Books Club members are also invited to participate in YouTube workshops with Zero Books authors and others. The music you're listening to right now is an instrumental version of We Shall Overcome, which was the unofficial anthem of the free speech movement back in the 1960s, before probably most of us were even born. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to C. Derek Farn and I discuss arguments for free speech and free thought.
I wanted to talk about John Stuart Mill, but you don't want to. And you want to talk about the Arab Spring, which I'm all for. Do you want
right? Let's talk about John Stuart Mill first, and then
I just had a conversation with Ben and put that up. Although the sound ended up being fairly distorted on that one, I'm not sure if anyone's going to listen to it. Look, I had Norman Finkel, and he's become a liberal. He's become a big follower of John Stuart Mill. I find the arguments that Norman put forward on the podcast with me and that are out there and they're from Mill around free speech to be fairly compelling as long as you don't question the original assumption, the utilitarian assumption about the value of truth. It's pretty solid. I mean, and the thing is that most people don't question that assumption about truth being useful. I mean, I think it's nearly as commonsensical as the idea of free will.
It's commonsensical, and yet to be like free will doesn't really stand a whole lot of muster, nor does its inversion, which is that truth has no use value. So to give some philosophical background to what we're talking about here, Mill tries to change the framework of utilitarian from sort of specific act-based to kind of general principle-based. And in doing so, it tries to like basically bring something like virtue ethics into a utilitarian framework, or something like deontology into the deontology framework. I say something like because he's not responding to either of those things exactly. He realizes that Bentham's open to the kind of critiques that Marx makes of Bentham. And although, again, there's no evidence that Mill's responding to Marx either. He's just responding to contemporary stuff in England. And he tries to ground all this stuff in a sort of baseline set of freedoms that you get in On Liberty that are sort of principle driven. So it's a utilitarian of principle as opposed to utilitarianism of act. Now, what that conflates, though, is use value, ethical value, and truth value as all being sort of the same thing. And as Nietzsche, who I know is your favorite person in the world, points out in, you know, Truth and Lies in the Ethical Sense, which is a paper he didn't even publish, but it's much used by postmodernists. But he does point out that this assumption is just an assumption. There is plenty of evidence in both directions that truth is not actually of use, and there's plenty of uses of values that would make truth irrelevant.
Well, let me just say something about Nietzsche real quick, and just to clarify my position on Nietzsche, which is, first of all, I mean, obviously he was a brilliant writer and a philosopher of note, and I don't dislike him. You know, it's like if I met Nietzsche on the street through some miracle, I wouldn't spit in his face or something. You know, like, it's not like I think this guy was an asshole, although even he might have been. But it's just that I think that his philosophical conclusions and the arguments he makes are fundamentally one-sided, and because of that, they're reactionary. And that's all. That would be my, you know, I could go further than that if we brought up particular parts of Nietzsche's thought. But the main point I would make is that you can take something from Nietzsche, but you can't stay with Nietzsche, at least not in Be On the Left. Not in Hold, that the human subject is internally split, that there is no straightforward positivity, which I think Nietzsche holds with. But anyway, that's just an aside, really. But with Mill, I kind of think of him in the same way as Nietzsche, which is like he has a few arguments that, once you accept his primary assumption, work fairly well. My question is, well, is there a way to have these same arguments work when you have different fundamental assumptions, when you don't have the same conception of truth value and use value that he does, and ethical value? I mean, like, I think the way, just to spell it out, I think the way Mill works on this is that what's ethical is what's useful. That what is better for humanity is what's useful. In other words, what brings the greatest good to the most people.
But there's conditions that Mill places on that people don't deal with. I mean, so, for example, Mill doesn't think that you can pray, "All right, hold to liberal principles," that they are only can be said to be useful in fully civilized societies. So, for, you know, and On Liberty, he says, "Until then, there is nothing for them but implicit obedience to Akbar, Charlemagne, if they are so fortunate to find one," and them being people in a pre-civilized society. So he actually does. There is a developmentalism there. The other thing is that he sort of takes things completely on an individual note. He also, you know, he tries to say that it is objectively true that happiness is what we should be aiming for. But instead of, you know, trying to figure out the utilitarian calculus and the individual acts like Bentham did, he tries to come up with general principles that can be abstractified as, you know, what leads to most happiness. So freedom of speech is a thing that leads to happiness because it allows for freedom of conscience. And this is just objectively true if you weigh this versus the damage caused by not having it. Which both equates use value, and there's a whole lot of things that are equated in that to make it seem objective. So, but Bentham is trying to get out of some of the, you know, obvious moral inconsistency and inability to derive any sort of set of principles that Bentham gets you into.
Mill is doing that.
But Mill still does have a historical conception. It's just, it was what I pointed out earlier, it's just not like a Hegelian one. It's actually not one that's grounded in a systematic historiography. It's sort of just asserted that civilized people would act this way, and we don't know about, you know, what we could say about pre-civilized people for a variety of reasons, because they have too much other stuff to deal with.
Some of his other arguments around speech seem to me to at least loosely apply to his own argument here about developed societies or civilizational values. I mean, isn't he himself presuming infallibility when he makes a judgment about another people regarding the state of their civilization or their ability to participate in reasoned debate?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, those kind of concerns are basically always a problem in the Anglo tradition. I mean, like one of the things that's frustrating about reading Locke or Mill or whatever is like they tend to have highly symbolic and actually metaphorical conceptions of when all this arised, and their definitions of civilization or civilized are at best rare, because they don't want to say it's economic, but they also don't not want to say that. So they kind of have their cape hanging of it too and use vague terms like civilization. You know, and a lot of times they'll use stuff like social contracts. Well, you know, the thing about social contract theory is there's no actual – we read it as metaphorical, but they're actually explicitly – you know, it wasn't originally meant to be metaphorical. It was an actual explanation of the end of state of nature, just like Locke's, you know, use principle and, you know, human ownership and value was one thing too. And if you actually look at your history, in the case of Locke, even in Locke's time, that was just flattened patent bullshit. So, you know, in the case of Mill, you're more removed, you know, you're about 100-150 years removed from all that. But when he makes categorical statements about civilization and when something happens or where something happens, you know, it's got all those assumptions built into it. He's not bothering to argue that and doesn't even think it needs to be argued, frankly.
I mean, look, here's my problem with Mill's free speech position and his argument about infallibility is that it's a Lacanian objection, but I mean, to call it that is to grossly inflate it, okay? Because it's not that brilliant of observation, but it's just the case that
we aren't infinite beings.
And on the one hand, that means we're not infallible. We can't know what's true before we debate it, before we have an open discourse, dialogue, and argumentation, all of that. On the other hand, it means we do not have an infinite amount of time for argumentation. And so that means some things almost always have to be assumed. I don't know on what level they have to be assumed, what things have to be assumed, but it seems like it's unavoidable just because of the lack of time for there to be the kind of thoroughgoing argumentation and debate that would seem to be implied by Mill's arguments. I mean, and that's why he ends up violating his own rules about, say, determining ahead of time that a civilization.
There's also a central contradiction in Mill. Mill wants to lay down a calculus for which we can determine objectively what happiness would be and based on ethics on that. But he also says on Liberty, this exact quote, "Human nature is not a machine to be built after a model and set to do exactly work prescribed for, but a tree that requires one to grow and develop itself on all sides according to the tendency of inward forces that make it a living thing." So that's a nice and neat metaphor, but it's also a cop-out. So on one hand, he wants to build an objective morality where you can literally plug in valuables and come up with abstract formalized rights. And he actually calls them formalized rights, much like Marxists do. But on another hand, he realizes that we don't understand human nature and that it's organic and that you can only come up with at best tendencies to kind of grow things along, but you can't come up with a rule. And he kind of came up with that because he was afraid of, you know, the mob, basically. I mean, it's one of these things that both liberal and anti-liberal people of the 19th century shared, is they were afraid of uncultivated mass reaction. You know, And which is not to say they were explicitly anti-democratic. Mill isn't. Mill's actually, you know, the most democratic probably thinker of that period. But he's afraid of the pressures of societies to self-repress and whatever. He sees that as essentially Christian. No, he doesn't go in. He avoids economic questions. Obviously, he thinks this is all in terms of ideas.
Look, there's lots of things to critique Mill about. I'm most concerned and interested in his arguments for free speech because I see, and maybe this is myopic, you know, I could be completely wrong about this, but I see this being a moment where commitment to free expression and free thought is wavering in a way I actually haven't witnessed before, and I thought it was wavering before. So I kind of want to reassert these basic liberal principles around free speech, but I don't want to do it by if I have to, like, take on every assumption or, you know, just commit to registering as a liberal Democrat or join the Labor Party in Britain or something. You know, I don't want to join up with the full project here, but I do think that this idea that we should be open to hearing the arguments of even the most grotesque sides of a debate has some merit.
But Marx already has an answer for that to you. You need to have the grotesque sides of the debate just because having them out there means you know what they are and where your enemies are. And it's not – and you don't ever want to suppress that speech because you need to know where the contradictions in society are. If you force them underground, then they will remain underground until they bubble up somewhere else much more powerful than they were before. This is
– Yeah, that's not that different from Mill's argument really because Mill says something very like that. He says – you do not know your own argument well until you know your opposition's argument.
Right.
You have not honed your argument well. You do not know the truth of your own position until you've tested it in the battle of ideas.
But, I mean, and in this way, suppressing speech, you don't need – I mean, Mill's coming upon the same thing that any person who thought even remotely dialectically would come upon. If you cannot state the oppositionary opinion, you cannot move forward. Like, you can't defeat it if it is unstated. Silencing it is not the same thing as defeating it. And I mean, here's the thing. I think that should be fairly obvious, but it's not right now because people have – you know, I've said this many times on our show recently, but people love the state more than they love their own values or even political economy or whatever. But they also fundamentally have forgotten that they're not in charge. And perhaps this could breach a topic that you and I were talking about separately about the memory hole.
Oh, okay.
You know, I brought up to you that I was teaching a class of 18-year-olds recently, and they're bright. I mean, this is not a comment on their intelligence, and I'm not just saying that. But I asked, you know, them to explain to me the Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street because we were talking about popular voices and the relationship of media to popular voices because it's a journalism class. And out of 120 students, only one American knew what I was talking about or was willing to say they knew I was talking about anyway. But I, you know, now my foreign students, which I have quite a few because even in here I teach in a school that has a lot of – they all knew it. But they were filling in the American students, even the things that happened in their own country.
Wow.
Now – you know, the memory hole and free speech, that's interesting to me because people are like, well, I didn't believe we would still be fighting Nazis, you know, after 1931 and, you know, whatever. Like, if you actually thought that, you were an idiot. And I'm just going to say that out now, that the quote unquote Nazis we're fighting now are the same thing as Nazis in 1940 is fundamentally just wrong. And two, it ignores the complicated relationship of the United States to both sides of this debate historically. And so, you know, parts of Nazi laws come out of U.S. laws, particularly Jim Crow, but also, you know, other things. But other things don't. The United States was just as anti-Semitic. But then again, even liberals – I mean even these same liberals who push this stuff right now will omit the fact deliberately that, for example, that FDR was basing many of his policies off of stuff he saw in fascist Italy. And any historian who knows half of the actual history of the time period will point out that that's just true. But because of idiots like Jonah Goldberg at the National Review pointing it out, now people feel like they have to deny it axiomatically. Well, the reason why that changed was political expediency, because Mussolini sided with Hitler. But that was not at all obvious in 1933. And Keynes's right. primary works were not known in America at the time for FDR to be basing his policies off of. So that can't actually be what people were doing, despite what heterodox, quote unquote, heterodox economists and liberal revisionists will tell you. The reason why I bring this up is right now we live in a memory hole, but I want to tell you what I did find fascinating. My kids knew about Vietnam, meaning they understand my parents and your quasi-parents' mythologies, because that was the last set of shared universal background noise.
What do you mean my quasi-parents? Are you saying I was adopted?
No, I mean like whether – I don't know if you were actually lost generation or boomers who were –
My parents were born in 1947.
I don't know.
So they're boomers.
Yeah, so they're barely boomers, yeah. This generation of kids I'm teaching is the last generation that's still millennial. Like my high school students right now. And literally, because they're born in 99. And and I am the first year that's considered millennial, depending on who you ask. Which is 36, and it just occurred, you know, because I'm 36 years old.
You mean
yeah,
in 1980.
1980, I was born in 1980. So okay. You got 20 years of birth.
So yeah, but I don't think that's not millennial anymore. I think you have to have been born like 83.
Well, it depends on who you read. But my point is, no one, we're not Xers either, because X ends at like 79 or something. So like
It ends at 80 now, according to some, right. You know, or 82.
Well, here's the funny thing. I just bring this up because I've been published in both anthologies. But my point about this is that even if you were born in 83, the amount you share with a kid born in 1999 is almost nothing. Right. And
you share more with a Gen Xer.
Yeah, and conversely, these kids share more with whatever Gen Z is, right? So my point about that is this generational politics won't help you understand what's going on. But one thing I have noticed is the decrease of a common background noise does mean that the memory hole really does seem to be bigger. So people don't know things that happened closer to their birth or even after it more than they know things that happened to boomers. Now, what does this have to do with free speech? Well, immediately it doesn't seem to have anything to do with free speech.
I think it has to do with the fact that we used to have a more centralized common culture, and the boomers were a generation that defined that culture. And then since then, it's become more and more fragmented, and it's easy to go through your life without even knowing about what's going on in the news, so to speak.
Right. It's very easy. And I it's funny because I thought people under 27 actually kind of seemed to call me a reactionary for even thinking this was a problem. But what I was trying to point out about free speech is people have already censored their own lives and their own exposure to other ideas to the point to where the step to removing another person's speech is just trying to prove your dominance in the society. But what I'm learning, all right, even for myself, because I've been abroad for almost 8 years, is that Americans don't know each other and act off of commonly assumed stereotypes. And the fear of speech is related to that. So people who want to censor the alt-right aren't afraid of just the alt-right's ideas. They're afraid that they cannot defeat them. Now,
you mean defeat them physically or with their ideas?
With their ideas. Or physically, let's be honest. They're all like everybody knows that while yes, they can beat up Nazis in Berkeley, that if they actually really go toe to toe in a place that's not a coastal liberal town, they're outgunned. Neither side is huge. What I don't understand is these very fools, and I'm going to call them fools. I'm going to be angry for once. Do not see that the power they are trying to give the state will be used against them almost first.
Right.
So what?
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, let's actually calm it down for a second. We immediately saw, you know, everybody, including Ted Cruz, talk about how Antifa has no moral equivalent to...
And that lasted about a week and a half or 2 weeks.
That lasted a week and a half because they attacked journalists. Well, immediately now, they're being, you know, they're, you see these groups being declared almost...
terrorist-oriented.
Being discussed, calling terrorist organization by the same people that were defending them, and people, quote-unquote, to the left of the people defending them.
They were been officially declared a terrorist organization, I guess, in 2016, when Obama was still president. That's what I read.
Yeah, the red and black and green and black have been on terrorist watch lists for a while.
Yeah, well, green and black has been on terrorist watch lists and since the least
since
the early 90s,
middle. Since the Clinton era.
So,
and what people don't realize is it's not even the right that's putting them on it; it's the center.
Yeah. Right.
And the center actually, you know, the right wingers. Actually gave Antifa more cover than the center left and the liberal and the center liberals did. And that you had Hillary Clinton talking about pulling down a private property Lenin statue, and Chelsea Clinton pulling down a private property Lenin statue, you know. And then you also had immediately people starting attacking, you know, saying, oh, well, it's not the same that George Washington and whatever get attacked as these Confederates, although I actually think, you know, that kind of is, but these things are infinitely unpopular. Like 60% of the population, and it's not all white, by the way, following those numbers, think that tearing the Confederate monuments off of government land is fine, but just attacking historical monuments and removing them is a bad idea.
It's another, I mean, look, we're talking about the memory hole, and you don't want to destroy all traces of historical memory. I mean, you don't have to keep a Confederate flag going or a Confederate statue up, but you might put it somewhere where people can see it instead of just destroying
it. I mean, it was ironic for me, too, that these people were using Germany's anti-fascist laws to justify this when the Germans, Christian Democratic Party actually started taking down left-wing websites under the same laws. I mean, it was like the irony can almost not be more spelled out for you at this point. And I also remember just I was listening to, you know, a bunch of skeptics podcasts. I don't know why I was being so masochistic to myself and hearing a center liberal, someone well to the right of us, complain about Mark Lilla saying that we should never talk about race, which is not what Mark Rulillo said. At the same time, listening to Sam Harris say that Black Lives Matter was, you know, objectively inflaming racism. And I was just like, where these people are believing they're on straw men. And this is related to the wanting to silence everybody up, because wanting to shut everyone up and pass these speech laws, you know, at a certain point, you know, speech codes, I do see the point of it being compassion or whatever. But what everyone says on both sides is trust us. You know, we know who the bad guys are.
It's important, Marion. Trust me. Trust me. Trust me. Trust me. Trust me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, look, the thing to understand about the right wing side of this is that the very people who are the biggest voices for free speech and advocating free speech in order to attack social justice warriors and campuses run amok, they're the very ones who are backing legislation to ban political speech from college campuses. The attempt to control and suppress the censorious left will lead and has been leading to censoriousness from the right from the state rather than from some unruly mob of tweens or whatever.
Right. But what's funny about all this to me is also the denial that this is happening, because I keep on listening to people, you know, who would argue with, like, say, Freddie DeVore, who would say that, you know, these events on colleges, they're minor, they're not common.
But there's been no empirical study on this that I know of, has there?
So what we've learned is there's about 40 or 50 of them a year. Most of them are left wing on campuses, but a lot of things that are no platforming and whatever are not considered part of it. There are also a bunch of right wing administrative moves to silence people that also aren't talked about. So both sides are effectively trying to control speech, but one side has been able to utilize the sort of mob mentality of specific events. Because it looks like a mob, it plays better on TV. It looks like a mob, but a mob against the majority trying to intimidate people. And you see this with the defense of the black bloc recently. It's just, I saw friends like, you can't criticize the black bloc. Why? Well, because, you know, they're silencing journalists because it previously. This has been used to shut down states. And if you only knew about, I actually saw someone say this in all seriousness, if you only knew what happened in the third world, you know that these things are necessary. One, black bloc tactics are completely unique to the first world. There are nobody who would do them because they're an intermediary stage of violence that most people would see as just destructive without seizing anything. So they break property or, you know, whatever, but they don't
take power in any shape or form.
Really take power. They don't take out key targets. They don't even really silence people.
Go ahead.
Two, the idea that this is some kind of effective red black terror against right wingers is just stupid. It might be in Berkeley because they're so outnumbered, but it's not anywhere else in the country. And Berkeley doesn't matter. Here's the other thing that people don't get right now. You're in a federated republic where these cities, where all the leftists and all these left actions are taken, are increasingly politically marginalized for things that you can't change unless you also take a few states. Like, you can make things more democratic if you took the states, but there's no plan to do that. Furthermore, very few people are actually involved in these fights. You're talking about groups of thousands.
Yeah.
I mean, and that sounds impressive, but it's actually really not. Like, a stick fight between 400 people in the center of a town is not massive. You have, and then you'll have massive solidarity things, you know, where like 90 fascists show up in Boston and like 6,000 show up to shut them up as a counter protest. But the thing is, they're in Boston.
That this turn towards, I called it vigilante justice, right? And I got called on the carpet for that. So it's what kind of Marxist wants to validate the bourgeois state and call the masses vigilantes? And I was like, well, you know, this one. Because, you know, there is at least a formal process for adjudicating crimes under a bourgeois state. As corrupt as it is, there's some level of transparency. It's not run as a whispering campaign, you know, amongst tribal personal friendship groups. You don't just decide, you know, that this person is a criminal and then go string him up. There's lots of problems with bourgeois justice, and we need to do much better. But that doesn't mean that reverting to warlike practices, not war, but warlike practices in everyday life is any kind of winning strategy or justifiable on any grounds, I don't think.
No, it'll give the state permission to crush you.
Yeah.
Which is what's happening. Because what you do, I mean, like, one, these people obviously don't even know, like, their own damn history from either the Stalinist purges or the Red Scare. You do this, people get afraid. They turn people over who are innocent. You have spiraling factors that undo your point. And you can see it on both left and right history. That's what happened in the Red Scare. That's what happened in the Stalinist purges. You scare people. They out other people to get to avoid justice. You set up quotas. There's all kinds of things that go on with that. And that rarely ever goes well. I can't think of a single time where it has. I've never known where those kinds of uses of charisma and informal process have gone well. I mean, and if you even want to lose, like, you know, the Cultural Revolution in China, the only reason the death toll was so high in that was that it unleashed a bunch of ethnic reprisals and a bunch of Confucian-based suicides. There were not that many, like, official state executions. What people died from in the Cultural Revolution was mob violence and like, fighting counter-protests between different groups of leftists.
Yeah, I know. It was a fucking giant struggle session that just tore – people were tearing each other apart.
And when it was implemented in other countries, the same thing. Most of the groups that implemented it literally either tore themselves apart, got those fractures, allowed government agents to better infiltrate and broke them, or they literally killed each other until there was almost no one left. If you look at the Red Army faction in Japan, in Germany, or you and I have both talked about the histories of the RCP and the SDS, and that totally is what happened. And people want to deny this, but the COINTELPRO did not manufacture fraught lines; they exacerbated them,
right?
And they used them as a point of entry. So, you know, people seem really surprised when people like Chris Hedges, you know, and Hedges is a stupid. I mean, like, Hedges' arguments are dumb. Don't get me wrong.
They are, and he's not a good ally.
No, but
and you know,
but he's not wrong that it creates all this space for people to literally to infiltrate and be provocateurs. Although it's also a lame excuse that liberals and center leftists have used to say that, you know, violence against camera people on the black bloc is, or against journalists, is really rare. And that's mostly provocateurs, where, like, missing the point is if no one knows who you are because you're hiding from the state, it also means you're hiding from each other, and no one can – you don't know anyone's origins. You can't vouch for it. And people forget in the Communist Manifesto, communists dare not hide their faces. And the reason for it is that we have to be held accountable to each other.
Yeah, I know. And I mean – yes, we need to be held accountable to each other, which is what I think is the most important thing to say to people who want to go out in the street and protect. You know, they always use the excuse of protecting poor, defenseless black communities or poor, defenseless Jewish communities from the hordes of Nazis. And so that's what they say they want to do if they really want
except
to do
except they're
that.
Never there. Like, that's the other thing. Like, yes, there are poor black communities around Berkeley, sort of. But they're not at ground zero. The closest thing we got to ground zero for this is a very liberal city in the South, and that was Charlottesville.
Yeah.
And we see what happened.
Yeah.
And what was interesting about that is both sides were screaming, you know, outside instigators and provocateurs. And if you look at who did the killing and who died, they aren't wrong. I mean, like, everybody was from outside the community.
Right. Well, they were outsiders. I mean, they were.
Both the alt-rightists were outsiders. They were coming from as far away as California, and the DSA and WWP, Workers' World Party people who were there, were also outsiders. Right. Yeah, there's all kinds of the IWW people were a lot more local. I'm trying to remember. I think some of the people that died were – I mean, one of the persons that died.
Heather Heyer was IWW. That's a rumor.
She was IWW and DSA. That's confirmed. I'm trying to remember. I think she was fairly local. I don't remember exactly. But the guy who
killed her wasn't. Yeah, right.
And
they, you know what? The alt-right and the far left, or at least the left, were arguing – were making two claims. One is that there was provocateurs and outsiders that did this. And the other one was – where were the police?
Right.
Why did
which is weird, right? Because, like, the police were letting them fight it out.
Yeah. Well, not so much the second day, actually, but there was
They were just incompetent the second day. But the first day, they were letting them fight it out as a statement of policy, which has also happened in Berkeley.
Right.
They do not get involved. But it's weird because if the police do get involved, very little good happens from it. If they don't get involved, I mean, like, if they got involved, they'd smash everyone's head, both sides.
Yeah.
And it would drum up a lot of sympathy for both sides.
Right. That's why they don't.
Right. But, I mean, the police have learned from stuff like Occupy and Ferguson that you don't get those optics. You know.
It's just and, such crap, you know, all the way around. There's nobody to – I mean, I think my – as a liberal, you know, as a Ralph Nader liberal, which is I play one, you know, like more and more every day. They have some sort of fucking obligation to step in and you know, protect the people from each other and stop crimes. Aren't they supposed to be like Superman? Oh, yeah, I forget. Superman and Spider-Man beat each other up on the street. Anyway.
Yeah, and they're vigilantes. But, no, I mean, here's the thing about the moment that we're in. Socially, we have not been more left as a country in a billion years, and I think that's something that's completely missed. Politically, we have not been more right as a country in a billion years, and how did that gulf get there? Well, I'll tell you one thing that isn't going to fix it. Thinking you can control the center towards your direction by limiting speech.